Welcome to Changemakers Without Borders. I'm your host and producer, Mai Cooper, and this is episode 2 of this new 4-part series with Professor Tara Brookfield, who is the author of Our Voices Must Be Heard, a book on the history of the fight for women's rights in Canada, and the author of a book about children's rights and the activist women who took care of them in the World Wars and the Cold War on the Canadian side, called Cold War Comforts, Canadian Women, Child Safety, and Global Insecurity. If you haven't heard episode 1 of this 4-part series, I highly recommend it. Let's jump right in. This show is broadcast on Peach City Radio, CFUZ, Radio Waterloo, CKMS, as well as Spotify and all other podcasting networks. What kind of protections did women have if they were abused at home? Was there anything?
Well, at no point was like domestic abuse approved. There was no time in Canadian history where it was seen as all right for someone to like physically beat and harm children or women. However, corporal punishment was allowed for both correction for wives and for children. And unless you were doing excessive harm, it would be very difficult to bring a charge of abuse. And excessive harm could be very difficult to prove. You needed to usually have a male witness who could support, for example, that someone was not acting appropriately. And there's lots of interesting court cases in which a woman will bring, let's say, her father in to testify on behalf that her husband was beating her or withholding food or those type of things. And if that person had a well-standing sort of position in the community, that would be very hard for these charges to stand because they would have thought, well, how could that person ever treat? So there was not a lot of understanding that domestic abuse could happen in any marriage, event people of any class, for example. So women at the time couldn't testify on sort of on their own behalf. You needed a male witness to present that. So it was difficult for people to leave abusive situations if you had no income of yourself to take with you. Abandonment happened, that type of thing. Women left, and divorce was incredibly difficult to achieve. It usually had to be on a charge of infidelity that could be proven. And so most people were stuck in relationships.
And this point about having a male witness is even harder than what we perhaps can imagine today, because women were not necessarily allowed to, quote-unquote, fraternize or be with any kind of male friend. It would be considered improper.
Correct. It would, I think, like if you were, you know, you could, you know, be with your brothers, and if everything was supervised, you could mingle with men. That was another concern for co-education, that the idea that men and women would be in classrooms together. And when, for example, University of Toronto first opened, they had the women all chaperoned at all times because there were concerns that this would just cause anarchy and the hormones would just be flying like crazy. So yeah, there was a lot of concern about inappropriate behavior. Most domestic abuse also happens behind closed doors. So who's going to be witnessing things? If it happens outside, maybe a neighbor is witnessing something, and if they feel like they feel it's excessive, and they can testify in that case. But right, it's difficult in those circumstances to find male allies whose voices would also be heard.
It's a huge issue even today in regards to rape. Well, usually rape doesn't happen in broad daylight, and you don't usually have friends of yours coming with you to protect you, because rape happens, you know, with no consent, and friends would protect you from it if they're good friends. So that's an issue that I think we're dealing with until today, and it really doesn't have much of a solution.
No, you're right. The historic precedents, even though women can testify on their own behalf, when you have cases of sexual assault, sexual violence, it's sort of one person's voice against another's. And how do you prove that if there's no witnesses or evidence? For example, it can be very difficult. And we see very high profile cases that become quite controversial when seemingly someone who has a history, for example, of abuse or many voices raised, and that's not considered sufficient evidence of wrongdoing.
I've got a body dark and strong. I was but not for long. You took me to bed a little girl, left me in a woman's world. You can take my body, you can take my bones, you can take my blood, but not my soul. You can take my body, you can take my bones, you can take my blood, but not my soul.
Going back to the issue of voting and getting the female vote, I'd like to ask you a question that may seem at first like common sense, but I think it's important to understand for this issue of women's rights and the issue of human rights in general, which is, do you think that the vote and getting the vote is fundamental to the acknowledgement of women's equality?
I think so. It's an interesting question because today voting is the voter turnout is so low in many cases. Among young people, among men and women, I think it's maybe hard to wrap our head around. It's like, well, if people aren't even bothering to show up when they have the right, how could it be so essential to human rights? I think for the people who are fighting for the right to vote, really felt it was an entry point into getting the vote itself as a recognition that they were worthy enough to make decisions to represent their communities, their properties, their nations, for example, and that recognition was important to saying, yes, you are a capable person. You're not
While we're on the subject of prohibition, I wanted to ask you about the importance of legalizing alcohol specifically.
So it's just
do you think that it was the right decision to legalize alcohol with the rampant use of alcohol today having wide-ranging effects, one of them being sexual assault?
To make change in other areas. So it wasn't just the act of voting is what that vote could do for them. So, for example, a number of women who were fighting for the vote were fighting because they actually wanted the vote to have the power then to vote for candidates who would favor getting rid of alcohol, prohibition or temperance movements. So for them, they thought if there was less alcohol, there'd be less domestic violence. And so they thought this will be a way to improve human rights by eliminating violence. So they were less concerned about the vote symbolic on its own, but they wanted the power the vote would give them to pressure candidates who would now listen to them because now they had a sway over who might get be voted into office.
While we're on the subject of prohibition, I wanted to ask you, what is the importance of legalizing alcohol specifically? And do you think that it was the right decision to legalize alcohol in today's world with its rampant use being related to more sexual assault cases?
So at the time when the women were entering these conversations, alcohol was legal. You could purchase it in a tavern. You could make it yourself. You know, there was big distillery companies growing. Some of Canada's first big corporations were beer or alcohol companies. And the women first thought, well, maybe temperance would be the way to go, that you could just forbid sales in certain regions. And if we think back to this period, it was a deeply religious era that also associated excessive alcohol drinking as sinful and wrong. And they felt people would make impaired decisions, to use a more modern term. You know, they might gamble away their money. They might might spend it all at the pub and then not have enough to pay their rent and support their family. So there was a lot of men who were also temperance supporters, many of them like very strict churchgoers. And there was also many women as well, who though also then framed it as a feminist issue, that without alcohol, there'd be less sexual violence, there'd be less domestic abuse. And they felt that while we might say that this, you know, wanting to get rid of alcohol is a very conservative idea from a 21st century perspective, they really saw it as a safety issue for women. And they were never successful in terms of getting sort of any temperance in during the period of sort of the suffrage era. And though we did have during certain towns and cities across Canada did have the right to have referendums in their own communities to decide whether they'd be a dry county, for example, and only alcohol would be sort of for sale, you know, in the next door town, which didn't really help things, because if you really want alcohol, you could go find it sort of just, you know, a carriage right away, or you can make your own and have it. So I don't think during the 1930s, there was more stricter rules about this, not as strict as the United States, which sort of went federally completely dry for a while, but it hasn't been an issue women have pursued to the same extent, although we could see like campaigns like Mothers Against Drunk Driving and other areas in which sort of there's been a more feminized movement to prohibit certain types of drinking like drunk driving.
Just taking out orders for Dad. I know that the stuff's full of poison, but me and my sweetie won't die. When we want a drink, we go out to the sink, the bootlegger's daughter and I.
Do you think it would be wise or not? I'm not sure with legalizing or not legalizing, if the prohibition makes it almost that people want it even more than if it was legal. I'm not sure.
I think that's been, whether you're concerned about like certain ages for drinking or classifying certain types of more, I guess, recreational drugs or as sort of illegal, there's always sort of temptation. If you legalize it, then you have control over it and the sale and the benefit of taxes, for example. So I think there's economic reasons, there's moral reasons, there's political reasons for the laws we have about marketing certain things as criminal or not.
On a women's rights type of perspective, what would you say, like, would it be better from that perspective to perhaps bar alcohol from universities where some of the more rampant cases of sexual assault occur? And there are statistics that show that sexual assault happens, 50% of them happen when people are intoxicated with alcohol.
That's an interesting concept. I think it would be incredibly difficult to police. I mean, we don't, like at my own university, you know, we need to have a license if we're serving alcohol at an official university function, but that's not where most students are drinking. They're drinking off campus. And so I know there's certain universities in conservative parts of the United States where the students pledge not to drink, for example, but I think it would be very difficult to enforce, like you said, like in terms of if something is prohibited, is that going to change behavior? I think alcohol complicates situations in which abuse or assault can happen. That's not the cause of it. It's people's behavior. It's people's, the rage that they might have or the power that they have. And I don't think removing alcohol would eliminate the feelings and beliefs that cause people to behave in certain ways.
Well, that's an interesting point. And going back to voting again, you were mentioning that, you know, we have very little people voting. And, you know, in the last election, 44% of registered voters did not vote and did not exercise this right that was so fought for. Some people, for example, women, you know, you write in your book, Our Voices Must Be Heard, that some women tied themselves to a gate of the Prime Minister, in front of the Prime Minister of Canada, you know, asking to be recognized as a free person who can vote, who has a say. So what do you think is the importance of voting?
Well, I think the women at the time who were fighting for this, and in some cases it was, you know, they joined a club and they sent letters or they signed petitions or they participated in public acts of education or public performances to raise awareness, or they wrote editorials, or in cases they did these very more militant acts like chaining themselves to a seat in parliament to protest their struggle. Or in both in Britain and the United States, women went on hunger strikes and they were arrested and there was much more violence around their resistance. but in all cases, they were always a minority. There wasn't a whole wave of women who wanted to vote or who were active in the movement. So in some ways, historically too, people were not always as politically active. Voting rates have definitely decreased over the years. And I think that has to do with a couple of things. Disillusionment, I think, of politics and politicians, and feel like, well, will my vote matter? What power do I have to change? So I think it's part of it is really unhappiness with the political system. And while we say we live in a democracy, how democratic is it? Or people who don't see themselves reflected in the candidates and feel, I don't want to support any of these people, they're all corrupt, or they don't really understand what I might need. And then I think there's the flip side of people who think it's society's fine and they trust that Canada is a stable enough system. They feel that their vote, whether they vote for Conservative, Liberal, NDP, it's not going to matter. Their livelihoods will go on. So I think you've got two reasons for the lack of voting, like lack of confidence and also comfort. And it's the people who usually aren't comfortable who feel their voices, like that if they don't see the right people in power, that their lives will be dramatically harmed. That's when we see movements. We'd see it protest in other ways today, but it's not happening around the vote as an act to for change, which is interesting, because it could be a very powerful tool to bring in sort of a party that's been on the margins, for example, and to sort of put about great change.
In your personal opinion, would you say that people today are less active, or young people are less active in the political, like the voting than they were before?
I think there's always ups and downs. Like there's not, I feel it's, we can't just generalize like all youth, just like we can't say all women act in the same way. I think, I know youth from my students. And a lot of them are very active. They do a lot of volunteer work. They're very concerned about climate change. They're very concerned about sort of the economy and the future. And many of them, feel capitalism is problematic. A lot of Indigenous youth are particularly active in issues about the lingering legacy of colonialism. And so I definitely know there's key issues that young people are very invested in. And there's different means of activism that didn't exist in the past. So they might not always be massing in, public spaces and protesting with signs, but they're doing a lot of activism online, for example. But I think we could just look at someone like Greta Thunberg as a role model for environmental youth activism. And I think the suffragists were a group who didn't have the vote, and many young people don't have the vote. Now they're not 18 or 21, depending on where they're living and where their voting rights are, but they're making noise and they're expressing their dissatisfaction at how adults have controlled things, or the decisions the older generations have made have impacted them and their futures.
Mm-hmm. Just to clarify, you mean that they're starting to talk even before they're getting to the voting age of 18 or 21?
Absolutely. I think a lot of young people are organizing about the issues that they care about, whether it's like LGBTQ plus rights or the environment, or concerns about different political parties. And so they might not have the voting rights, but high school students and younger people are active. And I don't want to dismiss them as not as prolific, let's say, as like a movement like the 1960s, for example, where we saw sort of mass mobilization in public spaces. They're organizing in different ways.
It might happen. Who knows? It might happen sooner rather than later. So I'd like to read another quote from your book. This one is by Flora MacDonald Dennison, who was the author of Women and War in 1914. Quote, "Many women are now filled with the spirit of patriotism, and the primal instinct to conserve and help is meritoriously showing itself in work being done. But let not the glamour of victory nor the sorrow of defeat blind women to the real important issues. The important issue before, during, or after the war is democratic freedom. And there is no freedom and no democracy while women are a disenfranchised class." End quote. So two questions for you here. First is, what do we know of Denison and what did she do for the suffrage movement? And also, what are your thoughts on this quote?
Well, that's interesting. Maybe I'll start with the second question first.
Go for it.
So she's writing that during the First World War, a time in which it was presented as a war against, a war fought to protect democracy, and that those who, you know, within the Canadian perspective, by defeating the Germans and their allies, preserved democracy. And so it gave suffragists an entry point to talk about, well, how can we have a democracy if you're excluding half the population?
Make your daddy glad to have had such a lad. Tell your sweetheart not to pine, to be proud her boy's in line. Over there, send the word over there, that the Yanks are coming, the Yanks are coming.
And Flora Denison was definitely on that page, but she was also very critical about war, and that publication was ultimately an anti-war publication in which she criticized militarism as a means of problem solving.
We'll be over, we're coming over, and we won't come back till it's over, over there, over there.
That we're going to sacrifice young men and fight each other and be violent, and that's not a democratic way of solving problems. And she was an anti-war critic, which was very rare at the time. She was controversial for that, and so I think it's important to sort of recognize that suffragists had a variety of opinions about the First World War. Some supported the war, some were pacifists, some were critics of the war, like Flora McDonald Denison, and others threw themselves into volunteering for the war, and some put suffrage on hold and some didn't. Herself, she was a really fascinating suffragist because she's a little bit beyond, she's unusual. Most of the suffragists who we know about, and I'm really, my research is on Ontario. So among the Ontario suffragists, she stood out because she came from a more working class background. Her family was certainly not wealthy. She was someone who always had to work to support herself. And she was a dressmaker. She was a seamstress. So she worked with her hands in a different way than, let's say, Emily Stowe, who was a doctor, who obviously also worked with her hands, but was trained and university educated. Flora was working with material, and she was an entrepreneur. She eventually rose from being a seamstress to having her own. She was first a manager at a department store and then was able to have her own sewing business, in which she employed people to sew for her, and she took over the business side of things. Most of the other suffragists probably fell into two camps. They were a bit more professional women in law and medicine and journalism, or they were wealthy wives of men who were professionals and they had time to devote to this cause. And now Flora also did journalism. She was a writer. She wrote a novel. She wrote for many columns for periodicals. So she was an intellectual as well. She also held radical beliefs beyond suffrage. So suffrage was very controversial and people were shunned for it. They were mocked for it. They were ridiculed for it. But it wasn't the only thing that put Denison on the fringe. She believed in free love. So she didn't believe in marriage. She thought people should be able to have sex outside of marriage and you should have common law relationships. She believed, she later moved into more spiritualism, which was not too uncommon at the time. She supported Emmeline Pankhurst, who was a British suffragist, who was part of the more militant movement and calling upon Canadian women to rise up and, if necessarily, you know, violently overtake the government to demand the right to vote. So the fact that she aligned with her made her controversial. She was into early environmentalism and she was anti-child labor and pro-women having child custody. And so she was involved in a number of things that put her aside. And in her own personal life, while the records aren't entirely clear, she was either in a relationship with a married man or she was living common law with him before he was completely divorced, or it's possible they never married. And then she was a single mom because that relationship disintegrated. And whether it was an official divorce or they were never married to begin with. So she cut a figure through this more traditional suffrage society as being much more radical. And she received hate mail for it, even from a fellow suffragist for calling her not a nice woman, for example, for some of her beliefs, particularly about sort of free love and divorce.
And when she was doing the periodicals and all her writing, did she use her real name, or was she allowed to publish?
Yes. She was active in the early 20th century when there was many more women journalists, and she never owned her own printing. Like she wrote columns for the Toronto Sunday paper, for example, and she wrote for Maclean's Saturday Night. And so she was hired, and people knew that she was she was a woman. Earlier women writers and journalists often published under a pseudonym or their initials because it was seen as more of a masculine pursuit. And so I write about someone else in my book, Mary Ann Shad Carey, who was the first female publisher in British North America. She's an African American woman who immigrated to Canada and established her own newspaper when she felt her political views weren't getting represented. And initially, she published under her initials because not only was she writing, she founded the whole paper. She was the publisher, and she worried about identifying herself openly as a woman.
Yes. What kind of hurdles did she have to go through in order to have a paper?
Well, funding was always a huge hurdle. It's an expensive process to have the equipment and to have the subscriptions to the paper at the time. So she was constantly worried about money and would do speaking tours to raise money for her paper. And that's what eventually outed her as the publisher with all her public appearances. She also, as a woman, experienced discrimination. People referred to, some of her critics called her a busybody in male's affairs, that she was, why should she have a voice to criticize? For example, she was very concerned about ending slavery in the United States. At the time of her time in Canada, the British Empire had ended slavery. And so she was helping end slavery from her position in Canada in the United States. So she was talking a lot about that. She was talking about Black men having the right to vote, whether they were free, if they were free in the United States, talking about men's right to vote in Canada, wanting women to vote. So they're like, why should you have such a medium to express your views? And so she received flack for that. And she was asked eventually from her supporters, who were her most, her funders, to maybe step down from the paper because they were having difficulty raising money once it became identified that she was the publisher. So she temporarily took a step back, took her name off the masthead, still was sort of in charge behind the scenes. But then once she was able to get more security and she moved the press from Toronto to the Windsor-Chatham area, she put her name back on there and said, like, this is my vehicle and I have the ability to do this and I'm not going to hide my my identity.
Thank you for listening to Changemakers Without Borders. I'm your host and producer, Mike Cooper, and with me was Professor Tara Brookfield, the author of Our Voices Must Be Heard, a book on the history of the fight for women's rights in Canada. You've been listening to part 2 of a new 4-part series on the fight for women's rights in Canada. I'd love to hear your feedback or any comments to my email, changemakerswithoutborders@gmail.com. It was a pleasure to have you listen to part 2, and I hope to see you in part 3. Thanks for lending your ears.